Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We're in the book of Numbers today. Numbers section called Korah. Everyone guess what that one's about? It's about Korah. This goes from Numbers chapter 16, to where we begin, through chapter 18. Korah, the son of Issachar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, separated himself with Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, son of Peleth, the offspring of Reuben. They stood before Moses with 250 men from the children of Israel, the leaders of the assembly, those summoned for meeting, men of renown. They gathered together against Moses and against Aaron, and said to them, "It is too much for you, for the entire assembly, all of them, are holy, and the Lord is among them. Why do you exalt yourselves over the congregation of the Lord?" Moses heard this and fell on his face. He spoke to Korah and his entire assembly, saying, "In the morning, the Lord will make known the one who is his own, and the Holy One, and he will draw him close to himself. And whoever he will choose, he will draw close to himself. Do this. Take for yourselves fire pans, Korah and his entire assembly. Put fire in them and place incense upon them before the Lord tomorrow. Then the man whom the Lord will choose, he is the Holy One. It is too much for you, O offspring of Levi." Moses said to Korah, "Hear now, O offspring of Levi, is it not enough for you that the God of Israel has segregated you from the assembly of Israel to draw you near to himself, to perform the service of the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the assembly to minister to them? And he drew you near, all your brethren, the offspring of Levi, with you. Yet you seek the priesthood as well. Therefore you and your entire assembly that are joining together are against the Lord. And as for Aaron, what is it that you have to protest against him?" Moses sent forth to summon Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. But they said, "We shall not go up. Is it not enough that you have brought us up the land flowing with milk and honey, and to cause us to die in the wilderness? Yet you seek to dominate us, even to dominate us further? Moreover, you did not bring us to a land flowing with milk and honey, nor give us a heritage of field and vineyard. Even if you would gouge out the eyes of these men, we shall not go up." This distressed Moses greatly. He said to the Lord, do not turn their gift offering. I have not taken even a single donkey of theirs, nor have I wronged even one of them." Moses said to Korah, "You and your entire assembly, be before the Lord, you, they, and Aaron, tomorrow. Let each man take his fire pan. You shall place incense on them, and you shall bring before the Lord each man with his fire pan, 250 fire pans, and you and Aaron, each man with his fire pan." So they took each man his fire pan, and they placed fire on them and put incense on them. And they stood at the entrance tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Korah gathered the entire assembly against them to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to the entire assembly. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Separate yourselves from amid this assembly, and I shall destroy them in an instant." They fell on their faces and said, "O God, God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with the entire assembly?" The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the assembly, saying, get yourselves up from all around the dwelling place of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." So Moses stood up. He went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. He spoke to the assembly, saying, "Turn away now from near the tents of these wicked men. Do not touch anything of theirs, lest you perish because of all their sins." So they got themselves up from near the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. From all around, Dathan and Abiram went out standing erect at the edge of their tents, with their wives, their children, and their infants. Moses said, "Through this shall you know the Lord sent me to perform all these acts. It was not from my heart. If these die like the death of all men, and the destiny of all men is visited upon them, then it is not the Lord who has sent me. But the Lord will create a phenomenon, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them and all that is theirs, and they will descend alive into the pit. Then you shall know that these men have provoked the Lord." When he finished speaking these words, the ground that was under them split open. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed them and their households and all the people who were with Korah and the entire wealth. They and all that was theirs descended alive into the pit. The earth covered them over and they were lost from the congregation. And Israel was all around them, fled at their sound. For they said, "At least the earth swallow us up." A flame came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. Chapter 17. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Say to Eleazar, son of Aaron the Kohen, and let him pick up the fire pans from amidst the fire. And he should throw away the flame, for they have become holy. As the fire pans of these sinners against their souls, they shall make them hammered out sheets as a covering for the altar. For they offered them before the Lord, so they became holy. They should be a sign to the children of Israel." Eleazar the Kohen took the copper fire pans that consumed the ones that had offered and hammered them out as a covering for the altar. As a reminder to the children of Israel, so that no alien who is not of the offspring of Aaron shall draw near to bring up the smoke of incense before the Lord, that he not be like Korah and his assembly, as the Lord spoke about him through Moses. The entire assembly of the children of Israel complained on the morning against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Lord." And it was, when the assembly gathered against Moses and Aaron, they turned the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud had covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. Moses and Aaron came before the tent of meeting. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Remove yourselves from among this assembly, and I shall destroy them in an instant." They fell on their faces, Moses and Aaron. Moses said to Aaron, "Take the fire pan and put it on the fire from upon the altar and place incense, and go quickly to the assembly and provide atonement for them. For the fury has gone out from the presence of the Lord. The plague has begun." Aaron took, as Moses had spoken, and ran to the midst of the congregation. And behold, the plague had begun among the people. He placed the incense and provided atonement for the people. He stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was checked. Those who died in the plague were 14,700, aside from those who died because of the affair of Korah. Aaron turned to Moses at the entrance of the tent of assembly, and the plague had been checked. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and take from them one staff for each father's house. From all the leaders, according to their father's house, 12 staffs." So that was verse, middle of 17 of chapter 17. Oh, really? Oh, yeah, yeah. You're going to be able to pick it up differently than mine. I apologize. Yeah, yeah. Sorry. This is my Bible breaks up the chapters and verses differently than other people's. Sorry about that. It's confusing at times. See, where was I? I was... That's all right. There was. Okay. The elders, according to others' father's household, 12 staves. Each man's name shall you inscribe on its staff. And the name of Aaron you shall inscribe on the staff of Levi. For there shall be one staff for the head of their father's house. You shall lay them in the tent of meeting before the testimony, where I will meet with you. It shall be the man whom I choose, his staff will blossom. Thus I shall cause to subside from among me the complaints of the children of Israel, which they complained against you. Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and all their leaders gave them a staff for each leader. A staff for each leader according to their father's house, 12 staves. And Aaron's staff was among their staffs. Lord, Moses laid the staves before the Lord in the tent of meeting, or testimony. On the next day, Moses came to the tent of testimony, and behold, the staff of Aaron, the house of Levi, had blossomed. It brought forth a blossom, sprouted a bud, and almonds ripened. Moses brought out all the staves before the Lord to the children of Israel. They saw and looked, each man his staff. Lord said to Moses, bring back the staff of Aaron before the testimony as a safekeeping, as a sign for rebellious ones. Let their complaints cease from me that they not die. Moses did as the Lord had commanded him, so he did. The children of Israel said to Moses, saying, behold, we perish. We're all lost. We're all lost. Everyone who approaches to close the tabernacle of the Lord will die. Will we ever stop perishing? The Lord said to Aaron, you, your sons, your father's household with you, shall bear the iniquity of the sanctuary. You and your sons with you shall bear the iniquity of your priesthood. Also your brethren, the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, shall you draw near with you, and they shall be joined to you and minister to you. You and your sons with you shall be before the tent of testimony. They shall safeguard your charge and the charge of the entire tent. But the holy vessels and the altar they shall not approach, that they not die, they as well as you. They shall be joined to you and safeguard the charged tent of meeting for the entire service of the tent, and an alien shall not approach you. You shall safeguard the charge of the holy, the charge of the altar, and there shall be no more wrath against the children of Israel. And I, behold, I have taken your brethren, the Levites, from the children of Israel. To you they are presented as a gift to the Lord, to perform the service, the tent of meeting. You and your sons with you shall safeguard your priesthood regarding every matter of the altar and within the curtain. And you shall serve. I have presented your priesthood as a service that is a gift to you, and alien who approaches shall die. The Lord spoke to Moses spoke to Aaron. And I, behold, I have given you the safeguard of my heave offerings, all the sanctities of the children of Israel. I have given them to you for distinction, and to your sons as an eternal portion. This shall be yours, the most holy, for the fire, their every offering, their every meal offering, their every sin offering, their every guilt offering, which they return to me. As most holy, it shall be yours and your sons. And the most holy shall you eat it. Every male shall eat it. It shall be for you, holy for you. And this shall be yours. What is set aside from their gift, from all their wave offerings of the children of Israel, I have presented them to you and to your sons and daughters with you, as eternal portion. Every pure person in your household may eat it. All the best of your oil and the best of your wine and grain, their first which they give to the Lord, to you I have given them. The first fruits of everything that is in their land, which they bring to the Lord, shall be yours. Every pure person in your household may eat it. Every segregated property in Israel shall be yours. Every first issue of a womb of any flesh that they offer to the Lord, whether man or beast, shall be yours. But you shall surely redeem the firstborn of man. And the firstborn of an impure beast shall you redeem. Those that are to be redeemed. From 1 month shall you redeem according to valuation, 5 silver shekels for the sacred shekel. It is 20 gerah. But the firstborn of an ox, the firstborn of a sheep, or the firstborn of a goat, you shall not redeem. They are holy. Their blood shall you throw upon the altar, and their fat shall you cause to go up in smoke. A fire offering, a satisfying aroma to the Lord. Their flesh shall be yours, like the beast, the waving, and the right thigh shall be yours. Everything that is set aside for the sanctities of the children of Israel, though they raise up to the Lord, I have given to you and your sons and your daughters with you, as an eternal portion, as an eternal salt-like covenant for the Lord, for your offspring with you. The Lord said to Aaron, in their land you shall have no heritage, and a share shall you not have among them. I am your share and your heritage among the children of Israel. The sons of Levi, behold, I have given of every tithe in Israel as a heritage in exchange for the service they perform, the service of the tent of meeting. The children of Israel shall not again approach the tent of meeting to bear a sin and die. The Levite himself shall perform the service of the tent of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity. An eternal decree for your generations, and among the children of Israel shall they not inherit a heritage. The tithe of the children of Israel that they raise up to the Lord as a gift I have given to the Levites as a heritage. Therefore I have said to them, among the children of Israel they shall not inherit a heritage. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, to the Levites shall you speak, and shall you say to them, when you accept the children of Israel, the tithe that I have given to you, from them as your heritage, you shall raise up from it a gift to the Lord, a tithe from the tithe. Your gift shall be reckoned for you like grain of a threshing floor, like ripeness of the vat. So shall you to raise up the gift of the Lord from all your tithes that you accept from the children of Israel. And you shall give from it a gift to the Lord to Aaron the Kohen. From all your gifts you shall raise up every gift of the Lord, from all its best part, its sacred part, from it. You shall say to them, when you have raised up its best part from it, it shall be considered for the Levite like the produce of the threshing floor, like the produce of the vat. You may eat it everywhere, you and your household, for it is a wage for you in exchange for your service at the tent of meeting. You shall not bear a sin because of it when you raise up its best part from it. And the sanctities of the children of Israel shall you not desecrate, so that you do not die. That was Numbers chapter 16, 17, and 18. A lot of stuff in here. Before we begin, any comments, questions, opinions, things you want to share with us, things I can answer for you if I have an answer. If not, I'll make one up. I've forgotten the definition of the heave offering. The wave offering is what is exposed upwards. Yeah, wave offering is similar in that I've forgotten the Hebrew words. What are they? Yeah, it's fine. The Hebrew words are it's verse 18, or sorry, chapter 18, verse 19, for example, or 18. Well, sorry, yeah, my verse 18. So breast of wave offering. Well, it might be different than mine. Mine's chapter 18, verse 18. Oh, your verse 11? Can you spell it for me? You spell it? Whatever. And what's the heave offering definition? Yeah, but what's the Hebrew word for it?
I can only find the Hebrew word for the offering that's mentioned there.
Terumah? Taruna. Yeah. Not exactly. They have their functions. I will make it a point to look up these two words, Louise, and I will get you the information for them as soon as I find out. Okay. Any other things I can't answer for you? Yes.
Korah was one of the guys that got swallowed up.
Yes.
Correct? Then who were the sons of Korah that helped write the Psalms?
Not all of his sons were destroyed. It actually discusses them. I think it's in... Oh, crud. I forgot which part of the... Which it's in the Torah, actually. It talks about the fact that not all of Korah's sons were destroyed. In the case of the people destroyed... let's see. Where am I? Marker there. There he is. So you have Dathan, Abiram, And these, specifically, those two sons, which are sons of Reuben, they have all their children wiped out. And infants and whatever else goes with it. That's all combined. And Korah's tent description does not say his children were there. It was Korah's tent specifically. Now, Korah is an old man. A very old man at this time. He's about, most estimate, somewhere in his mid-80s. About basically the generation, because he's the same generation as Moses and Aaron are. They're born roughly the same time period. So he's about in his mid-80s, maybe a little older, could be almost 90 years old. It does not say his children followed him. The children were specifically with Dathan and Abiram of the tribe of Reuben, that they are the ones who were following, and they died with him. In the case of Korah, it is his tent specifically, so it would be him, his wife, and being that old, I doubt he had any kids left in his tent. I mean, he could have, but probably not, unless he has, a really young wife. He probably didn't have any kids left at that point in time that were still living in his tent, his household. They obviously, because they did not agree with him or did not die with him, I would suspect they didn't agree with Dad. Difference of opinion. They don't necessarily follow him. So in the case of children wiped out, is these two. However, in the case of Korah, it is his specific tent that got wiped out. Does not specify he was standing there with his children, young ones. The other two were specifically state they were standing with children, young ones. Mind you, Korah himself was still out there with the tabernacle with his fire censer pan while this was going on. So he himself was on Adda's tent. He was actually out there at the fire pan with all of the other 250 men. With his fire, they're all supposed to sit there and wait. Well, in the case of Dathan and Abiram, they didn't come. They stayed at their tents. It points out that Korah's tent, and we separated themselves from it, so all of his goods and things he owned, and anybody who lived in it, went down into the hole. The 250 were killed separately. Yeah, so this event is taking place at three separate locations. So if we have the tabernacle, you have Korah and his family, for Kalkri, they're on the... The Levites surrounded immediately, but Korah's family is the sons of Kohath. So they're on this side. They're on this side. And then also Reuben. Well, Reuben's also on the same side. There's Reuben and the other two tribes. Reuben, is it Gad and Simeon? I've forgotten. I don't remember. Anyway, Reuben's also on this side. West side. Yeah, so... Moses and Aaron, and they specifically were on the east side of the tent. Meaning, Aaron himself, his particular family, hung out on this side of it. On the east side of the tabernacle. So the entrance is here, as far as going into it. Yeah, Moses and Aaron are there. But the Kohath's family is on this side of it. So Reuben and Kohath's family, they're probably relatively close to each other on their tent locations, I'm guessing, because they agreed with each other. They both said, hey, we'll move up next. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Oh, I had it wrong. I apologize. So Korah's on the south side. Thank you. Gershon's on the other side. So Kohath down here. I apologize. So Kohath's on the south side. I know. Don't do it in pen.
I'm lucky if I can find it.
I know. So that's why I have erasable markers. It really helps. You screw up. Shh. Don't see anything. So Reuben's this side. Kohath's that side. So you have Reuben's south side. No, so they're both on the south side. I apologize. Get them all right. They're all on that side. I mean, they're all together, most likely together, in that same generalized area or location. So they get split open, and obviously swallowed up. Oh, right, the next place. So this thing takes place at three locations. You have Dathan and Abiram's tent, wherever they're at, they're there. Korah's tent, probably nearby, that's the third location, and the second location. The third location is the entrance to the meeting, where all the fire pan censers are hanging out in the front door, or near the front entrance. So you have this location, that location, that location, where all these events are occurring. Now, as far as the final event, where Aaron has to go off and separate and run into the death plague, it doesn't say where that took place. I don't know where that site, but it's obviously somewhere around the generalized area, because he can run there. Whoever watched or witnessed the Korah's and Reuben's destruction down here, those three tents, may or may not have seen it from the fire pans for the 250 men, but all of them were supposed to stay here with their fire pans until God finished off his judgment, I guess. Judgment, correction, smacking upside the head a few times. It just was more permanent than that. Make sense? So three living spots is events taking place. You can probably see all three spots if you're the right spot, but the right location. But are there three different locations? Not simultaneously, no. Because Moses is actually hanging out here. Moses is the one who's allowed to travel around, because Aaron has to stay here with 250 men also. You see, he's stuck. So Moses travels from these 250 men to Korah and Dathan and Abiram's tents. So he's allowed to walk around and do stuff, but he's the traveler. And Aaron and all of his buddies, or I guess the other people who disagree with him, are all hanging out here on this side. So Moses gets to walk around. So we see Moses going from this location to that location and walking and discussing and going through this process. Yes?
So this was all clearly to define clearly once and for all, I'm the guy that God has selected. It's not about me. This is about who God wants to do his work. So stop, to clarify so that they will hopefully stop grumbling.
That's a general idea, yes. Now, if you note, back when they were giving the Ten Commandments, roughly a year or two, whatever years earlier, the people were all standing there all nice and clean, and the mountain, big noise, thundering, lightnings, whatever. They all got scared after they heard the Ten Commandments. They were scared of it. Said, Moses, you go and just relate to us what's happening. Well, what's the problem with that when people do that? Yeah. Well, did God really say that, Moses?
Yeah, right.
Did he really mean that? It's always now you have a filter. You don't have your direct information. You're going through someone. Well, that someone could alter, change, or tweak things. And against, and you not know why or how it's happening. So when you do that, when you make this barrier between you and God, you have to make sure the barrier is transparent, which means perfect in relaying information with no mistakes, no errors. Which is fine when you have a perfect human being doing it. Messiah does a pretty good job with that. It's not so fine when you have a normal human doing it. Now, in the case of Moses, it says he's the most humblest man ever lived. So most likely he was being as honest in the process as he physically knew how to be. He wasn't perfect at everything, but he's trying to be as honest as he could. So he was a pretty good relayer type of information person. But in spite of that, that doesn't mean that people who are going to hear his words and actually agree or believe what he's saying is actually what God truly wanted. No, God no longer is talking to the people directly. So all they see is a cloud and fire and cloud and fire and cloud and fire back and forth, back and forth. And Moses goes in, Moses goes out, Moses goes in, Moses goes out. And that's all they really see. They don't hear what happens. They don't hear the conversation that takes place. Nothing. So all they're going is tricked by what Moses appears to them to be doing. What's the inherent problem when you see someone, a single individual, wielding all this influence with this cloud? It's jealousy. You assume the person is getting on their own. Hey, you're just trying to make yourself get better or get greater, rule over us, as Korah claims. Now note, Korah and the Dathan and Abiram all had different complaints. We'll draw it out here. So the Dathan and Abiram, who were they specifically complaining against? It was against Moses. Dathan and Abiram's complaint was Moses. Dathan and Abiram. Now these two were sons of Reuben or descendants of Reuben. So they were not after the priesthood. What were they after? Moses' job. Now, what was Korah after? The priesthood. So Korah's complaint was Aaron. So Korah wanted the priesthood, and these two men wanted the rulership or the control of everything. They had two different complaints against two different individuals. Right, well, God pointed out when he talked to Moses initially with the burning bush, I will make you like a god to Pharaoh. And so, while he's like God to Pharaoh, he's like God to everybody else, because all he sees, he's, splitting red seas and doing all these miracle workers and cracking rocks and water comes out. All this stuff happens and it's all Moses doing it. It's like a god doing it, because obviously human beings can't do those types of things. So, all the people see are Moses doing all the work, and of course Aaron, his brother, nepotism right there, being benefited or being raised up over everybody. Well, it doesn't look very good, but that's the problem which occurs. These two men were against Moses, not against Aaron. Korah was against Aaron, not against Moses. Make sense? All right. Any other questions or comments so far? We don't know what the plague looked like as far as how it acted. Obviously, it was fairly quick. A lot of people dying. Yeah. So whatever the plague, you're right, it was a progressive plague. So wherever the location was, lost my marker. Oh well. It traveled through the camp because Aaron was able to run toward it and stop it, as opposed to being just randomly spotted everywhere. Much like opposite of the plague where the snakes came and it would bite all the people, they all died. Well, snakes are all over the place. And so wherever you were, you had to stop and look at this pillar of snake and you'd be fine. Well, in this case, the plague was from one place and goes across. That's not uncommon the way God did plagues. In the case, for example, in David's time, the plague that he had to deal with, done similarly. It was traveling across the country of Israel as David was king. And so, and then as he went to or was approaching Jerusalem, the plague stopped because he sacrificed some oxen and bought this land and all that kind of stuff that happened in recorded Chronicles, as well as Kings. And of course, David sees, when he stands there, Chronicles records, he's looking up and he sees this angel with his sword drawn standing there, waiting. And so when David, that gives you the image that as if this angel came across from one place and went across killing people all the way along until they finally stopped. Much like how an army would do things. So David sees this, or David interprets this, what he's looking at, how he's seeing it. Similarly, apparently, God seems to work that way as a general idea, as far as you start from the spinning, work your way across. Not that he always does that, but he did in this particular instance. Here's my marker. Any questions or comments so far? Does that make sense so far? Yes, Dan.
I felt like Abba can do whatever that he wants, and he didn't have to really say anything to Moses. He could have just wiped everybody out, but could that have been a test to see how Moses would answer him, you know, instead of saying, yeah, go ahead, you know, he's like, no, you know, could that have been testing?
It is. Note, Moses and Aaron are types of messianic figures. Well, if you expect them to be like a Messiah, what kind of behavior would you want your Messiah to be like? So you want someone who is an intercessor by nature, who desires to stop any difficulties upon someone, because that's what you need. That's the nature of a Messiah, is someone who delivers you out, an anointed person who delivers you out. That's the idea behind it. And deliver you out into death, deliver you out of death. So that's the idea. So you would want any example of Messiah to be one who delivers somebody out of their problems. If the messianic figures didn't do that, when we were looking for Messiah, we would not recognize him. But now, since we see Moses and Aaron doing and behaving this way, as well as not just them, many other messianic figures throughout the Torah do the exact same thing, as well as after the Torah, as well as the judges and such, the same way. They're all acting out a particular lifestyle, a particular way that demonstrates that they are intervening or stopping a negative or bad thing happening upon somebody else. You want someone like that. So it's not so much, I wouldn't say, a test per se as Moses and Aaron's character, as is a written down example for us to read about Moses and Aaron's character. God knew what these men were like. He dealt with them all their lives. He knows what they are. He knows what their intention is going to be. He wouldn't bring it up unless he already knew the answer. It's much like in a courtroom. Never ask a question to the defendant unless you actually know what the answer is going to be, or witness. You make sure you know what the answer is going to be, so you make sure it leads exactly how you're trying to go. Well, in this case, God's the same way. He knows Moses and Aaron very, very well. He knows their behavior. He knows how not just them, but also their fathers and this patriarchs before them behaved. So he made scenarios work out where they actually behaved and went along with their own character, and it mapped out perfectly for us to watch and see and read from. So God knows these men. He's playing on it so we can read and understand what a Messiah looks like. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions or comments so far? Yes.
Okay. In verse 18:15, it says, let me get my glasses on. Here, I'll hold that. Everything that opens the matrix in all flesh, which they bring unto the Lord of men or beasts, shall be thine. Nevertheless, the firstborn of man thou shalt surely redeem, and the firstling of unclean beast shalt thou redeem. Can you give me what you think that is?
I can tell you what the Bible says it is. Does that count?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's us, is it not? Us, our firstborn.
All firstborn. Let me erase this real quick.
It's the flesh of man, right?
Hold on a minute. It's pretty straightforward as far as what it's referring to. So in the case, it gives a few examples. Back in Exodus, I don't recall which chapter is off my head, but it points out examples of what you will redeem. You're obviously firstborn of man. What's the firstborn of man? Human beings. We know what those are. People. All right? Now, first about unclean species, unclean beasts. What's an unclean beast? Give me an example.
Pig,
donkey, whatever. So pig, donkey,
horse,
camel. All these various things. What's an example of a clean animal?
Cow.
Clean. Cow. Oops, that's a goat. C. And goat. Sheep. I will include chickens. Oh, you're right. Chickens don't open wound. I apologize. You're right. They don't. They don't. Open womb. Yeah. It's a clean animal, but it does not open wombs. Yeah, I'm sure what else opens womb. Giraffe. They open wombs. There's a few others. So you have firstborn of human beings, obviously they're people. You have obviously unclean animals, which you cannot offer kill, that is, an unclean animal on God's altar. Right? We know that. That the whole book of Maccabees, there's that over and over and over again, that's the big, major, major sin. You don't do that. So you have to redeem the animal. It instructs in Exodus, if we choose to not redeem it, and it gives the example of a donkey, which would be inclusive of a horse as well. If you choose not to redeem it, what must you do with the animal? Break his neck. You kill it. Not by offering it on the altar, but by killing it instead. So these are the examples which you would give. So the donkey, which includes a horse as well, because they're all considered the same as far as same species animal, it would be the example given that you would kill it if you don't redeem it. The redeeming price, they vary the price based on the type of animal it is. Certain animals are worth more than others. But human beings are all set, 5 shekels. So people are all redeemed at 5 shekels.
Where do they get these 5 shekels from? Where do they look
at it? They have money. Yeah, the Egyptians. Where did they get the money from? The Egyptians have lots and lots of money. when they came out of Egypt, they plundered Egypt, right? They got a lot of gold and silver and copper to use to build the tabernacle and all the furnishings of it. Lots of gold went in that, a lot of copper went in that, a lot of silver went in that. Well, and they also took the head count, which I think was half shekel, if I recall correctly, for each person, half shekel of silver. For each person, they counted when they took the first census, and the second one too. They took two census. Well, yeah. They counted people twice. That's each one's a half shekel account. Well, that adds up too. So I have 5 shekels. They want according to 20 gerahs and all the measurements that match. So they have money. On top of that, you have a whole bunch of people in the wilderness with no farmland. If I was going to be a wise businessman, I would send all my caravans that way. Say, here, buy this. Hey, you want some fresh vegetables? Buy this. I'd make a lot of money off of them. So they're going to have, I'm going to send caravans that way because there's a whole lot of people there who need food, need supplies, and I have them. So I will, instead of sending people straight to Egypt, as my caravan normally route would go, I'm going to divert them. Let's travel down a little further south and hit the Israelites and sell stuff to them too, and then we'll continue on back down to Egypt. It's called good business practices. So they've been hanging out in the wilderness for a long time, and all the nations around them know they're all there. It's not a big secret. They're all aware of where they're at. They all have been watching. They have their scouts. They have their spies. They know what's happening. When they move, everybody knows they're moving because it's a big group of people. So you have money. You have supplies. You have things happening in and around the area. So that's all happening. So firstborn people you must redeem. Why? Why do you redeem the firstborn of Israel, firstborn of people? Anybody remember what the reason is? Well, that's true. That happens later. But this redemption occurs because a result of Egypt, right? Of coming out of Egypt. What did God kill to get them out of Egypt?
The firstborn of
Egypt, right. Firstborn animals too. So all firstborn gets redeemed of whether you're human, unclean, or clean. Because God killed them all to get them out of Egypt. All the firstborn were wiped out. So in this process, he said when he did that, he purchased or set aside all future firstborn of Israel, which means human, unclean, and clean animals. They all belong to him. That was the price. That was his payment price. He paid Egypt's lives. In return, he receives Israel's lives as the exchange. Unlike, you know, a war which men kill, this is when God kills. You can't defend yourself against God. So in this case, all firstborn belong to God, regardless of which
tribe they come from, how many siblings may have afterward makes a difference. All firstborn go to him. Now, he says the firstborn of Israel that's not part of Levi, he was making a swap out or exchange with the tribe of Levi. He counted all the firstborn up. I forgot how many there were. So many thousands of firstborns. They did the math, added up all the sons of Levi, and they did some subtraction and some math and figured out who gets paid for what. So they did a direct swap. Well, that swap to that generation at that moment in time. They said, here's Levi's sons, here's firstborn of Israel's sons, we'll do the exchange now. But that does not take care of all future generations. Those come later, because we have birth, we have kids. So that firstborn process is going to be redeeming forever. It's a never-ending cycle. Not just this generation, but all generations. So every human born has to get redeemed, or if he doesn't get redeemed, the idea is he has to go into service in the tabernacle. So a firstborn not redeemed would go to service tabernacle. Can you do that? No. You can't do that, because if I have a son of Judah, or descendant, firstborn, okay, here, I don't have the money to pay for redemption. Here, go work in the tabernacle. What's going to happen to my son? He'll be dead. He'll be dead. He's not a Levite. You have to have a Levite in there only. God said only Levite comes in here. So Judah, my firstborn son, my whatever I may name him something, who cares? I can't just send my firstborns in there, because God said only Levite comes in, not the rest of Israel. But God owns my firstborn son. So I can't send him to work in the tabernacle, and I don't own him yet. So what do? I redeem him. I buy him back so that I own him. Hence, I pay God. God, I will buy my son from your son from you, your servant from you, and I will raise him as my own and continue on my family line. So that firstborn process is a never-ending cycle. It includes humans, obviously unclean and clean animals. This has been discussed many times in the past, the details of clean and unclean animals. We'll discuss those today. But this redemption is a never-ending cycle. Does that make sense? Hopefully it makes sense to everybody. It's a never-ending process. Any questions or comments so far? I'll make this relatively short because we have new moon to go through to this afternoon. Yes.
What was the symbolism behind what God had Moses do with the rods in chapter 17?
Rods. So there's 12 rods. One for each tribe, right? We get that in he specifically stated that Levi's rod, you will have Aaron's name written on it as the example for Aaron's rod. Sorry, it's Aaron's rod, have Levi written on it. Not the other way around. So all the rods. Note, the one he said it will blossom with bringing forth buds and produce ripe almonds and such. Almonds. What are almonds? They taste good. They're eyes. Yes. So almonds represent eyes. So if you have eyes, so when God's pointing out he's going to choose one of the rods to blossom and produce something, he chose Aaron's rod. I am guessing Aaron's rod was probably from an almond tree, but may not have been. I don't know. Either way, he chose the almonds. And the point of the symbolism of almonds is God sees. Because almonds is a particular species of nut. Obviously, it's shaped like the human eye when you're looking at it. But the idea is that it's called the heedless fruit, or one of the heedless fruits, which it does not care how cold it is. When it's time to come out, it blossoms forth, even though the rain, storms, snow may still destroy it. It doesn't care. And it also is one of the later, not the latest, but one of the later ripening of the nuts. So the idea, the eyes of God, since it opens up early and ripens late, it's as if God's eyes are always open. They're always open. Now they open up early, meaning the blossoms go out early. It's like kind of like the plum trees around here. They open up too early sometimes for our season. Almonds are the same thing. They open early because it's still supposedly wintertime, as in it's still dark outside. The idea of the symbolism is that God's eyes even look in the dark. They open up in the darkness to see things. So in this case, when using almonds, anytime the almonds pop up, it's the idea of eyes. This association comes from the menorah. The menorah God described, he says, you will make it as an almond branches with almond buds, and he describes the whole thing as an almond tree as you make the menorah. And then Zechariah explains the candles, all seven of them, are the eyes of God. So it explains, okay, you have the menorah with the almonds and the eyes of God on top. It implies almonds and eyes are associated to each other. They're designed to look or to see. So that's the idea behind it. So when God chose the rods and did the almonds on Aaron, that God sees all the tribes and he has chosen to look at one. This has two views of it, or two ways of looking at chosen, look at the one. In the tabernacle, which is up here, you have the lampstand, there's a table, the lampstand's over here, and this, which obviously is supposed to look at the table. So when God's seeing, when God's looking, what's he looking at? Well, in this symbol, he's looking at the bread, which is the 12 loaves of bread, which is no different than the 12 rods are up here. He's looking at the 12 different tribes. Well, in this process of looking at them, when the high priest comes in, who does God want to see? In this case, Aaron. So whose eyes, when God's looking at his, looking with his eyes, he's saying, my eyes are going to see almonds, which is Aaron. So I want to see Aaron. He could have spelled it out in word form, but he did it in symbol form. I'm going to use this rod, here's my almonds, it's going to produce buds, it's going to produce blossoms, and ripen almonds all overnight on a dead stick, which is impressive.
Yeah.
And the point is, God's saying, when you come before me, I want to see Aaron. When Moses did this, where did he put the rods specifically? In front of the testimony, which is here. So that's actually God's throne. When God's throne is sitting there, you put the rods in front of him, he wants to see one man. Well, obviously his descendants too. It's Aaron. He doesn't want to see anybody else. Everybody else, you're not allowed to go away. Does that make sense then? So that explains the rod scenario. He talks in symbols a lot. He's very good at it. Go figure.
So then that's representative of Jesus because he's a picture of Jesus.
Yes.
So that when if you want to enter into the throne room of God, he made a way for you to do that, but it's only through one man.
One individual, yes.
I want to see Jesus. So you can come in, but you better be inside Jesus.
Right.
Or else, you don't go there.
Exactly.
So the curtain was torn, but you still can't go in.
You still can't go in without him.
Without Jesus, or you will die.
Right.
Okay.
Nothing changed. The symbols have stayed the same. Because God doesn't change. Humans do, but God doesn't change. So you wrote it out, it's going to map this way out, it's going to always do it. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, well, that's also the picture you see in Revelation of Yeshua standing amongst the lampstands.
Oh, right. Yeah, that quote there on the back banner. As he holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks through the seven gold lampstands. So he's the one who God is looking at. That's the symbols behind that idea. So that kind of makes sense so far as who Aaron's playing and the role he plays in this? Yes.
Sorry. It's been a while since I've been back. So.
Sorry.
It just reminds me of something that I have heard is that the idea that, well, isn't God some kind of sadistic person to think that, you know, if you don't have Jesus standing between you and the Father, then he's going to slay you because he thinks that you're so awful. Right. And without this is where the understanding of Torah becomes so important. Because without the understanding of Torah, you don't understand the full nature of the Father. It's not that he's sadistic. It's that he's holy. And if we think for a minute that apart from Jesus, there is anything holy about us, we're in such big trouble. So it's not that he's sadistic and we're awful and we're horrible. It's just plain and simple that we're just not holy. And he is.
Yep.
And we need his holiness to cover us.
Yeah, we are awful, yeah. We aren't that great. But you're right, we do require him. We have issues. There are lots of problems for us. Yeah, that's the idea behind it. You always have the one in front of you that will take care of the holiness aspect of it. He said, besides it, his blood will cover your sins, which means you have to stand behind him at all times, so he's always one in front of you. Yes, Carrie.
It's kind of an interesting point. I actually had a conversation with one of my daughters yesterday because she gotten herself into trouble on something, but it just kind of, you know, of course I was praying about how to talk to her, but all of a sudden it came to mind, you know, because she just needs her perspective shifted on some things, and she's been fighting against this parental control aspect. It's like, well, wait a minute, you know, you've got 15 months left of this protective barrier that you're not even using. You know, and it's kind of, that's what God's trying to provide for us is this protective barrier, you know, but we have to comply with the way he says to do things in order to take advantage of it.
Right. If you tell Messiah, get out of my way, I don't need you, bad things turn out for you. it doesn't look well. any questions or comments? This is a little bit hodgepodge presentation because I'm going a little bit late, but I'm dragging this out a little bit. There's a few things I want to point out to you in this section. I'm not covering every little detail as I normally do. Let's see here. We'll jump to... Okay. So sons of Levi, what's their responsibility in this situation? What's their function?
They have to take care of the tabernacle.
Now, in the process of taking care of the tabernacle, what responsibility comes upon them?
Well, each part of the tribe has a different job they have to.
Yes, they have different tasks. Now, all the tribal Levites, as a whole or as a group, has one symbolic task that they always take care of. All the sins and iniquity of the children of Israel have to come to them, and that they come to the high priest and go before God for them. So Levi acts as an intercessor. For all of Israel. Now, in the process of them doing that, what is their payment? What's their wage? Well, it says, of the tithes is their benefit. Yeah, so some percentage of whatever they're offering and what's the details. Right. Exactly. The grains, some of the funds, whatever, of the tithes, they receive a portion of that to do their work. And they have a responsibility for it, though. What's the responsibility of the tithes? They take a percentage of that, or in this case, a tithe of it, and goes to Aaron, the high priest. A tenth goes to the high priest. You get, basically, whatever you receive, 10% of that is going to go to the high priest and his family and his lifeline, and the rest of it you have to take care of your own needs. In doing this, they have a responsibility. What's the responsibility when they receive a tithe? To recognize where it came from and to point out that this is as if I raised these animals and grew these wine grapes myself. So tithe is in payment, but it's a symbolic payment, as if they're the ones who actually grew it, which they didn't, but the ones who actually grew it. So in the process of doing this, what do they not receive? No land. They don't get land. They don't get their own property. They can't bequeath this acreage to their children or grandchildren. It doesn't happen that way. Nothing is theirs. It's just a service tax only. That's the requirement. The high priest is the same requirement. Whatever he receives, requirement is, in his benefit, he receives no land. So this is power without power. Authority without authority. Because when you have a king, what does a king own?
Everything.
If you have a high priest, what does the high priest own? Nothing. There's a big difference between the two of them. High priest owns nothing. It's just given to him. He has to maintain what's given to him. He doesn't get to own it. So there's a big difference between them. So in Levi's case, they get raised up in the fact that they're doing a service task. The nature of being this servant, they own nothing. It's not like, say, a vow of poverty per se, but it's the idea that you don't get to receive any gradual or building up of wealth. It doesn't happen because you can't own it. It's just you eat it because you can eat it. That's about the extent of what you can do. You don't get to accumulate things. So in the case of power, that's how it's supposed to work. So when Korah complains and wants Aaron's job, what's Korah perceiving? And what's his complaint? This is in chapter 16, verses 1 to 3. He starts off in his complaint. This is the gist, the total of his complaint. Son of Korah, the son of Kohath, Levi, blah, blah, blah. Verse 2. This is before Moses, with 250 men. They gathered together against Moses and against Aaron and said to him, "It is too much for you, for the entire assembly, all of them are holy, and the Lord is among them. Why do you exalt yourselves over the congregation of the Lord?" So what's Korah complaining about? He's complaining that's what Moses and Aaron are doing in particular. But what does he want? He wants their love. He wants their holiness. Which, what does he perceive comes with that? Power.
The original communist.
Yeah, the original communist, right? He wants their holiness to get power. Now, what's his pretext in claiming why he can do this? Because all the congregation of Israel is
holy.
So his theory is that God separated all of Israel to be holy, a unique nation. Is he right? Yes, he is. He did say for all Israel to be a unique nation, a peculiar people, a strangeness about them. That part is correct. He's using an example God gave and then twisting it to his own personal gain. Yes?
I see that happening today with the whole idea that we have been given the fullness of God. I mean, in the New Testament talks about we're already seated with Christ in heavenly places. And there's this whole move of it is finished. We've gotten everything. We can go and we can do it now. You know, but we're actually not seeing that that's a reality because, yes, we've been made holy. And, yes, we have the Spirit, but we have a measure of the Spirit. So I see that kind of similar. I don't know if it's correct
it is.
Or not.
That's a reasonable kind of reasonable example.
Okay, good.
Yeah, because in the case when the previous couple chapters, when Miriam and Aaron challenged Moses about his wife and a few of the times they also were challenging him, God points out, hey, I speak to people in visions and dreams, whatever, but Moses speaks face to face. So Moses put in a position to receive a personal one-on-one conversation of going back and forth, which none of us get to do. We can't say, God, wait a minute, let's have a conversation, discuss this. He can't. Everybody else has to receive a lesser or a weaker or a percentage or a smaller aspect of their relationship with God. And Korah recognizes that. However, he wants more of it. Yes, Jeff.
That's why in Paul's instructions when he talks about, you know, not all are called to be teachers or apostles or such.
Right.
It basically is to recognize what gifts and what role you've been put in and be content and be thankful and to, you know, work out with your utmost to what task you're put to.
That's, and it's well put. Some of us are not called to teach. It's absolutely right. Some of us, however, are called to be successful in business or that or other thing and have employees and do all these things we want to do. And what benefit is that? Well, they're benefiting all these people they're hiring. They have jobs and wages and distributing out wealth that way. That's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. So each person has their task, whatever it may be. We say, well, that guy's blessed with this, that guy's blessed with that, that guy's cursed with this. The reality is these are all workings in a single idea or concept of humanity and life. So we're all going through it. And that's a great way of pointing out that when you're at a position, whether you like it or not, accept it and then become content with it and then you will learn to love it and receive and be blessed by God. We may not get everything we imagine we would love to have. The point is, you're not supposed to. If one man receives everything, what good is that to anyone else? Nothing. Yes.
Well, and there's one glaring thing missing here too, is that somehow in the process from them getting scared from God talking to them directly to them, you know, to him to say, okay, fine, I'll use you as a mediator. He's obviously lost his fear of God.
Right.
Because if you have the proper fear of God, you don't start thinking that somebody elevated themselves, so therefore you can too? Because that's really what he's saying.
That's what he's arguing, yes. You're right. It's a perspective. Yes, Bill. It's a perspective which you have to pay attention to. It's always there. Always remember who you're dealing with.
What you said earlier about learning to live with it and like it, that 1 Thessalonians 5:18 comes to mind. And everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you.
Right. Right. I won't go there today. But yeah, it's an important process that every human goes through. I don't know any one of us who haven't had to learn if we could be content. We have to accept it. It's a hard place to be sometimes because you want more sometimes. But if just a little bit, that's the hardest place to be. To know, I don't get a little bit more. This is what I'm given. And accept it. It's really difficult, but it's an important thing to learn and do. Yes.
Yeah, to touch on Carrie's point a little bit further, it seems to me that the lessons of Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, uh-huh. That incident had just maybe happened 6 months, maybe a year at the
Give
most
or take.
Before
it's
this.
To say exactly, yeah, yeah.
You know, I could see if that incident had happened 20, 30, 50 years before that you might have forgotten the point, but this is like 6 months or a year after that incident. He seems to have totally forgotten what happened to them.
Yeah.
He smacked them down.
Pretty hard.
Very hard, yet he's doing this.
Yep. Which they should have realized, wait a minute, those two guys, they offered a profane fire for the Lord, and God struck him. And Moses saying, hey, everybody, let's go offer profane fire for God. Oh, wait a minute. Make the connection. It turned out really bad for the previous ones, and they were descendants of Aaron. Anyway, so Korah perceives the sense of holiness. He wants the power. Of course, so does Dathan and Abiram. They obviously want the power as well. The idea of lifting someone up above or above the people. The idea of God lifting someone up, is nothing wrong with that. He did it many times. He lifted all of Israel up. He lifted up individual tribes up. He lifted individual people up. He lifted up the kings above Israel. They all have their tasks and their job to do. Nothing's wrong with that concept. The idea of what he wanted was more than what he had. What do we call that? It's called the 10th commandment. What was that 10th commandment? Do not covet. So what was he after? He was coveting the power and the holiness and everything else that would come with it. So he was breaking the 10th commandment.
Isn't that also pride?
Pride comes with that as well. Coveting, there are many, many forms of it. It's, I don't have that, I want what you have, get out of my way. Or I will do what it takes to get what you have, because obviously God made a mistake by giving it to you. He should have given it to me, because I'm better. It's the idea of coveting. It's very encompassing of all things. Wanting something that is not yours. What does Apostle Paul call coveting?
I don't know.
Idolatry. Whatever it is. It's idol worship. It's idol worship. It's the idea of making an idol out of something which you want, which you were giving undue desire for this thing, whatever it may be, whether it's power, money, wealth, who cares. You're putting your desires on it, which you're elevating that thing, whatever it is, up higher than it should be. And you want it to come resting on you, because of course you want it. The idea of coveting is idol worship. It doesn't matter what you're coveting. Person, place, thing, power, money, it's all different. It's all idol worship. That's what it is. It's idling. It's all coveting. It's all breaking the 10th commandment. It's a hard one to not break, isn't it? It really is hard, because we want things. Well, it's not the nature of wanting things. The point is, be content with what you've got. Master what you have. If you've mastered what you have, what will God give you? More. If you master what you have, what will God give you? More. In Korah's case, he did not master what he had. What did his sons master? They mastered more. What did Korah's sons end up doing? They wrote many of our Psalms. They mastered the concept of praise and worship. That is greater than what Korah did. Korah wanted holiness and power. His sons recognized dad. The idea is master what is greater than that, which is praise and worship. Yes.
So the idea isn't that it's wrong to want more. The idea is it's wrong to demand more and take more for yourself, as opposed to Korah's sons waited for God
to give it to you.
To give you the more.
Right. What
so
you master what it is.
You master what you have. You're content. You're thankful, you're praising, you're at peace. And then you wait on the Lord, and the Lord will bring you the more.
Right.
The Lord will bring
you the
more.
There's the example of the talents given out. What happened to them? The parable of talents, right? So some increased, they took what they had, they mastered, made it better, and the one that buried it, what happened is? Well, give it away. Take it away from you, give it to somebody else who actually did more, who can take what he had, master what he has, and now put more on you to master even more. The idea is what you have, master it. Korah had not even mastered his task yet. What was his task? Well, all the furnishings inside the tabernacle had to be cared for well. That's not such a simple thing. What's the big deal about that? How hard is that? It's more than that. He has to be learned to be what it means to a servant. Yes.
I think that it's really important that we don't miss the point that you just made about the fact there is a strong revelation in that Korah's sons became worshipers.
Yes.
So how do we know when we've mastered the assignment that we've been given? We enter into praise.
You do.
We
yeah.
enter into praise. We're thankful. We can
point.
Praise God. I think that's really
that's
key because we need to know those markers, you know, and I think that's very
That we have successfully done this. And not only that we've done what we were assigned to do, as Korah's sons showed an example, that we've taken care of the tabernacle, taken care of the stuff in it. Now we're going to add to our responsibility, not by taking it, but by offering it up. Because praise and writing psalms and doing something, that's an offering you give. It's something you're giving of yourself to do it. It's something which you're given to you. You give it to somebody else. That, so they learned, the work is this. I've done my work. I've mastered my work. Now I'm going to offer what I have to God. In this case, I wrote psalms, I wrote songs, I take care of people, and I serve the people as I celebrate and worship God. So they were blessed with that, and of course, their writings got made it for thousands of years, and we get to sort of read what they wrote. That's a good blessing. We see that they actually grew beyond what their dad did. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, well, that's a great observation of what role he and his family actually had. Of they basically had a front row seat into the service of God with taking care of the various furniture that's in there, and not realizing that kind of a blessing to be able to help people with this relationship encounter with God. So thus, his sons later on, they, through the Psalms, were able to take the experience of a relationship with God further out to the people. I mean, all the people knew what was happening in the tabernacle.
That's a big deal, too.
But that took that outside the tabernacle as well, so the people could participate.
All right, I erased it. Well, anyway, my drawing I had here, which had Korah down below, and his son is his co-half, but it's all Korah's family's in there. Their job is exactly correct. They're watching, they know anything happens inside. Well, their job is as instructors of Israel, which is what Levi's job was. You will then take this information and then carry it out, disseminate it out amongst the people of Israel. A few of the kings, we read in the book of Kings, did that as well, took it upon themselves to make sure that happened. Some of them didn't, but a few of them did. The idea was take what God has given you and then spread it out. Levi, if in modern day terms, the people of, the descendants of, essentially we consider them teachers or instructors today. That's what their job was. You would hire them, come to my house, teach my kids how to read, write, and praise and worship God. Do them correctly and teach them well, and my children will raise and they'll do things well, and God will bless them. That was their supposed task. So they have the individual sons who have the responsibility inside it, individual descendants, and to do certain tasks when the tabernacle is moving. When it's not moving, what is their job? Bring the information out here to the people and vice versa. When the people have offerings or problems, bring that back in. They're supposed to continue to go through this cycle of serving the people continuously. It's a good job. It's a hard one, but it's a good one. I'm running out of time, so I do a new moon this afternoon too. So I'm going to skip a few of these details. But one thing I want to rattle off to you, which I think is relatively important. I can skip that part. Hold on. Okay. How do we recognize Korahs in the world?
People who cause problems with
leadership. Well, sometimes leaderships are corrupt. Sometimes leaders are corrupt, though.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Korahs. There's lots of them, by the way. I won't rattle off their names, because I don't know all of them. But there's lots of Korahs in the world. What is our instruction on how to spot when someone is or is not acting like Korah? Sometimes you want someone to act like Moses. When Moses intercedes and say, hey, God, wait a minute. This isn't right. Do this way instead. This is better. This is kinder. This is according to your name. That's a positive thing. As opposed to someone saying, wait a minute, God. No, wait a minute. Do this for me because I'm better at this. That's a negative thing. You have to be able to recognize these details. I'm not saying that everybody's this way, but when it comes to Korahs of the world, my personal is 2 John. 2 John records a quick spot, a quick easy spot. So second book of 2 John, there real quick. Jude also talks about the same type of thing, but 2 John in particular, jump to verse 5 through, well, the 2 John, book of 2 John, starting in verse 5. And now I plead with you, lady, not as though I wrote a new commandment to you, but that when we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. This love that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment that as you have heard from the beginning, you should walk in it. For many deceivers are gone out to the Lord, who do not confess the Messiah as coming in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an anti-Messiah. Look to yourselves that we do not lose those things we worked for, but that we may receive a full reward. Whoever transgresses and does not abide in the doctrine of the Anointed One does not have God. He who abides in the doctrine of the Anointed One has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not believe him, or do receive him into your house, nor greet him. For he who greets him shares in his evil deeds. have many things to you to write. I don't wish to write them in paper and ink, but I hope to come to you and speak to you face to face. That our joy may be full, that your elected sister greet you. Amen. In John's, the way I read this, John's description here, there's a few details which you'll spot with somebody who is a false teacher, a false instructor, or a Kora. What will they be missing in their instruction? Yeah, so you have transgressed commandments. Mind you, did Moses transgress the commandments? No. Did Aaron transgress the commandments? Did Korah transgress the commandments?
Yes.
So, spot transgressed commandments. That's not so good. You have a spot of somebody who's doing things incorrectly. And when your transgressor does not abide in the doctrine of the Messiah, does not have God, of course, does not abide in it. So if you transgress commandments, you're not abiding in him. What does abide mean? To live, to dwell, to live in it. So the transgressor commandments does not abide in God, or in the Messiah, sorry, in particular. And walk, this love, we walk according to his commandments. So his transgressor does not walk. What are the commandments he doesn't walk by? All of them. They may not see it. Somebody may not necessarily have to walk through all of them and realize they may or may not be. The point is we're trying to spot Korahs, the people who are gaining for them for their own personal gain, their own personal increase, to lift themselves up. Korah is someone who's trying to lift themselves up above another individual or a group of people. They transgress, do not abide in God, does not walk according to the commandments of God. Now, mind you, I say all of them. It depends on the type of person. I realize that there are commandments that apply to Jews and some apply to Gentiles. It depends on the person you're dealing with is. But did Korah do any of these mistakes? Yes, he did a few of the mistakes. What mistakes did he do? Any thoughts? What were they? Well, let's see. What commandment did he transgress? Coveting. What else did he transgress in the form of coveting? Coveting is, well, group idol and coveting is kind of similar. They are related. What was he coveting? The priesthood position. He's coveting the priesthood. So what was he doing by coveting the priesthood? He was putting himself in the place of Aaron, which is the same as putting yourself in place of Messiah. Same difference, or one the same, the symbolically. So he lifted himself up as if I am a Messiah, or I'm a type of Messiah. Which, I throw this out there, I know it's wrong. Bar Kokhba revolution, that guy is Bar Kokhba. You ever read about him? This person put himself in the place of Messiah. Good example of what happened. He killed a lot of people, and screwed up really badly. But he was a Korah. The point is, John's warning out, beware of these men. You have people like this in existence at his time, the book of John's time, as well as the following few generations. People will do this. They put themselves where they don't belong. So Korah tried to put himself in the priesthood, which is put himself in Messiah's position, as if he can be there and he deserves it better than others. If he is in his position, in Messiah's position, is he abiding in Messiah? No, because he took the position. He said, Messiah, get out of the way. I am there better than you. So this process of which he has is failing, shortcomings.
Korah is like a type of...
We call him a type of Antichrist, anti-Messiah. And Antichrist is, we think of, oh, it's the... No, the... Not a the, it is an... And there's many, many, many of them. Anyone who is against Messiah of any form is a type of Antichrist. Some extreme, some minor. But they're always the same type of anti-Messiah. So he's a type of them. There have been thousands of them, and there will be thousands more, I'm sure. So nothing's going to happen here. So nothing's different. So he coveted, he wanted the priesthood, but he's trying to take Messiah's job, obviously Aaron's job as well. So he didn't abide in him. Then he's transgressing his commandments. When you transgress, what's the Torah say you must do? Repent, but repent in what way? In the case of Korah's transgression, when you approach God and you've done something, Jeff said it many times over, the way in which you will, Korban, bring yourself approach near to God, which Korah is doing. He's following Moses' instruction. Here's my fire pan. But there's a way in which God said you will approach me. And how would you approach me? Which includes what components in Korah's lifetime? which includes certain offerings which you will do, certain sacrifice offerings. Ah, terrible marker.
A sin offering.
Offering subject must be offered. Now, what kind of offerings? You read the sin offering is a type of offering. There's other offerings in particular. What did Aaron have to go through to be where he is? He had to be cleaned a whole bunch of different ways, purified with atonement offerings, a whole host of things Aaron and his sons had to go through. So this is atonement. There's a blood offering. There was the right thumb, the right ear, the right toe, all those things. There's a whole bunch of stuff that he had to do to be there. What was Korah trying to do? I'm going to bypass this. I'm going to go around it. Wait. So you have somebody, an example of someone who's transgressed the Torah. He's covenanting. He wants a priesthood. Obviously not abiding God. He's bypassing all the instructions God told someone to do if they're going to be a high priest. Is he walking in the commandments of Messiah?
No.
He's purposely going around them. So when we spot or look for Korahs, what are we going to look for? Someone who's going around it. Somebody's trying to say, well, just do it this way instead. It's faster. It's better. See? Here's the problem. And Jeroboam. Yes, when Jeroboam divided them up, he broke the transgressive commandments. Not going to quit as God commanded. He made Jeroboam the first. He made all the people of Israel. Anybody want to worship God, come and worship him. You want to be a priest, come and be a priest. Pay some money. It's yours. He did things. He bypassed the entire instructions. God doesn't change. He wants instructions followed correctly. Yes.
I wonder if that's similar to today with Jesus and how so much of today's preaching and teaching and tickling of our ears is bypassing any suffering. That the purification process, the sanctification process, really doesn't need to include suffering. That it's going to just be all about blessing and all about prosperity and all about having our dreams come true and all about having our goals manifested and just dream it and you can do it. But and there's very little suffering, very little sacrifice. I'm wondering.
But suffering and sacrifice takes a long time, doesn't it? It does. It takes years, in case a lifetime, to go through it. It's a process. Well, who wants to go that long? It's much faster to say, well, here's my fire pan. I'm good. It's very easy. It's human nature. We all do it. Oh, that's so much work. It's easier. Isn't there an easier way, God? Yes, Jeff.
Well, one of the greatest things that the offerings and the process of sanctification teaches you is that you need to be cleaned up. You don't just waltz in as you are.
It's a big deal. As we mentioned before, earlier, pushing Messiah aside, saying, get out of my way, I'm going to see God too, that's not a good thing for you. That results in bad results for you, for your ending. Because it's not positive. It ends negatively to you. So you don't want somebody else who cleans you up to get out of the way. You have to make sure he's in front of you. That's an important part. Which Korah, his job should have been, Aaron, what do you need me to do to make me as close to God as I am allowed and can be without dying? That's his job. He didn't do that job. He chose his own way of doing things. Stealing. You're right. That's a form of stealing. Or trying to. Yes.
It really minimizes the price that Jesus paid. I mean, if you think about Aaron being the picture of Messiah, I mean, that was a lot of detail. I mean, you got to do this to the right ear and the left hand, a lot of washing, a lot of detail. And you think about the preparation from the ancient of time of that Jesus had to go through, not to mention just the pure suffering he had to go through. And we want to just push him aside and go, oh, no, I can come in here and I can get sanctified myself real quick and easy. Thanks so much for your blood. I'm good. You know, it really minimizes what he had to go through.
That was never God's intent, was to minimize it. We as human beings, we do minimize things. That's our nature to do so. We find the easiest way. It's common. Path of least resistance. Yes. Carrie.
Well, another thing kind of in line with Shannon's other comment is replacement theology.
It's the same idea.
People
that's
not
identical
respecting
to it.
The position that right. God gave the Hebrew right. people when he chose them and set right. them apart, you know, and just thinking, oh, we can just waltz in and replace them because we have Messiah.
Well, the veil's been torn, right? So we're all good. Now we can walk in.
Also, a thought that came to me is that this, I know it's not the priesthood specifically, but this is the exact opposite of David when his captain wanted to kill Saul right there because they were standing
right.
over him.
Right.
And he said, nope, that's not God's process. We're not doing this.
Yeah. Because yeah. You're murdering. Yeah. He knew that you would be breaking a transgressing commandment of God in many different ways to do that. And that's an important thing. He was not going to be a transgressor because once he did that, there's not much you can do about it. You can't say, well, here's my offering, God. It doesn't work that way. A murderer, you will kill by the hands of man because you murdered someone. And that's what David's big thing about Joab when he killed Abner. That, hey, he did this on his own. I didn't command him to do it. It's a big deal. I had nothing to do with this process, which Joab did. And Joab, of course, had to be killed by Solomon later. But that's the whole nature of, it's a big deal. You don't get to transgress, because when you transgress something, you have to go through the process of cleaning it up. And murdering a person, it's only one process that takes care of that. You die too, because you're a murderer. I'm going to call it quits for the day. We've got about 5 or 10 minute break or so, and then we'll go into, I'll get our new moon stuff out. We'll go through new moon session for the next 20 minutes after that, and then we'll end for the day. Any comments or questions before I call it quits for the day? All right. Close the prayer. Almighty God, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, thank you for our day, for our discussion and worship and study of you. Father, we ask you to bless our new moon service that comes. You'll grant us peace to be good servants, to follow you as best we can. That when we know you placed us wherever we are, that we be content with what it is and succeed at what you've given to us. We praise and trust you, Father. Give us patience and give us kindness. In Yeshua's name, amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.